career sucks.
Sex just isn't the same.
What's my purpose?
Where did this fat come from?
My relationship is killing me.
I'll never be happy.
My debt is piling up. I'll never find love. Why can't I be like other gay guys? Hey guys, it's time to get a grip, stop whining, make a bold move, and do something amazing with your 40 plus gay life. Let's get to the show with your Tell It Like It Is host, Rick Clemons, who does his best to never act like a dick or a diva unless you act like one first.
Hey guys, welcome to another episode of 40 plus gay men gay talk. And for many of you, you know what it means to be a baby boomer. And some of you even know what it means to be a late bloomer. And when you put those two things together, guess what? You got a whole lot of knowledge to share. And sometimes it can be really humorous and really frustrating when you're trying to talk to this younger generation, if they'll even give you the time of day, about how things used to be. And I know I was a guy who came out late in life, 36 years old. And I'm like, well, you know, I knew some of this. But then I surrounded myself by what I would call some elders from the community. And I had an elder in my life. My uncle was someone who was in the gay community. I got to see part of his world, and he passed away. He was actually one who passed away through the AIDS epidemic, but his story got lost with him. And I wish I would have had more opportunities to talk to him. Well, today we are going to be having some really great conversations about the fun and the interesting ways that these bridges get built so that the generation gay gap gets closed up a little bit more. I love that our author is addressing the gay generation gap with his new book, Late Bloomer, Baby Boomer. His name is Steve Milliken, and we're going to dive into his book and his world of being a teacher in an urban ghetto and all that came along with that while he was navigating his own gay ghetto. So guys, I know you're in for a treat today. Steve, welcome to the podcast. I'm really excited to be having this conversation with you. And I can't wait to dig a little deeper into your book, even though I did dig into it prior to the show. So thanks for being here, man.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah. So school teacher. Oh, boy. Good on you, man. Like, God bless you. Let's just say that. I had two children. I feel like I went through school with them, which I did. And I'm like, I could not be a teacher. I would probably, that would be the reason I would be bald, but I'm already bald. So, so as a school teacher, I can only imagine that you had a lot of experiences, but then you were a school teacher in kind of a, like a urban area, ghetto area, and a gay school teacher at that time, which had to be its own little journey. So where would you like to like start the journey here of explaining where you came from? And okay, I know you came from your mother and father, but you know, like your journey of being your gay self and all of that, where would you like the story to begin today?
Well, probably it wouldn't start at teaching because I didn't start teaching until midlife and I had no idea what I was getting into. But after college, I decided I still didn't want to grow up. And so I did stand-up comedy and improvisational comedy, and I was pursuing a career as an actor. As a joke, I used to say my problem with acting was I was a comic character actor trapped in a leading man's body. But another problem with acting back then, this would have been in the late 70s and the 80s and the 90s, was that most of the casting directors were gay men. And they would go out of their way not to cast an actor that they perceive as gay, whether, you know, not being flamboyant or anything like that. But it just was next to impossible back in the 70s and 80s to be openly gay. So, of course, I wasn't. But, you know, I did comedy improv workshops and I did really well. And I was usually one of the top funny people in the workshop. But then once I got to a certain age, I was always a waiter part-time and I was like, you know, I can't do this anymore. And so I became, a hairstylist for a few years. I went to beauty school and then that was like, fulfilling this desire of playing with life-size dolls. Although, cause I never got to play with dolls when I was a kid. And when I finally realized that that's what was going on, I got bored out of my mind because who wants to play with dolls when they're an adult? So one of my clients said, you know, to become a teacher nowadays, you only have to have your BA and you go to the district intern program. Mm-hmm. So Oh, so that was the start of another change in careers. I say as a joke, I schedule my midlife crisis. So I literally, I had no idea what it was like doing teaching. And they literally, like, I got hired on my first interview at Huntington Park High School in Southeast Los Angeles. And they basically said, you know, here's the key, here's your keys, good luck. So I was taking district intern classes, which was the equivalent of going to graduate school and mm-hmm. teaching full time. So, but at that point, I felt like I had no choice. I mean, if I had known what it was going to be like, I don't think I ever would have done it.
Right.
I say it was a don't ask, don't tell situation, because in public school, you can't be openly gay, because if you don't have classroom management, you can't teach. And there would just be too much, you know, the students are ruthless. So, but I never said I wasn't gay. So students would say, like, oh, mister, are you married? And I go, oh, you know what? I don't talk about my personal life with my students. And they were, well, why not? And I'm like, well, that's my policy. But the thing is, and then they would back off, but only a gay teacher would say that.
Right.
So, you know, it's like teachers have like pictures of their wives and their kids and everything. So basically it was like a don't ask, don't tell. So, you know, I would bring up sometimes, you know, being gay would come up, but I never personalized it. And so it's like some knew, some didn't, but they just knew it was don't ask, don't tell. And so that's how I succeeded in being a really good teacher. And, you know, as my passion has always been making people laugh and doing stand-up comedy and improv comedy. So I would do that in the classroom, and I was always like making the kids laugh, and that lowered the effective filter. And so the kids like really liked me, although it was very challenging, of course. Mm-hmm. But I was a different kind of teacher, because I was always incorporating humor into the classroom, but I was a really good teacher and I taught what I needed to teach. Yeah. So yeah, but that didn't happen till, you know, but yeah, growing up gay, it's like I tell some of the young people, like, there were no gay role models whatsoever mm-hmm. growing up, none. And nope. And the depiction of gay people on film was either you were like the foppish, you know, comic character actor, you know, like a fool, basically. Or yep. if you were a decent people, you were dead by the end of the film. Mm-hmm. So, and then nobody talked about it. When I had my Birds and the Bees talk with my dad, he basically did like a really lousy job. And he just goes, but here's this book. And it was the book, Everything You Wanted to Know About Sex, But Were Afraid to Ask. So I immediately thumbed to the section on being gay. And Dr. David Rubens, he literally said, all gay men only want to have sex, anonymous sex in bathrooms, and like that's it. He literally wow. says that in the book. And so I thought, oh, that's not me. But the denial was just so strong, and there was nobody to talk about with, and it was just a completely different time. Nobody talked about it. It was never in the media. So I was, and of course I didn't want to be.
Of course not. No, I think for most of us that are the boomers, it's like, I'm sure many guys listening to this right now are like, yeah, totally can relate. This was my life. And that was my life. I mean, I remember, I have to really think about when like Three's Company was out and everything, but you know, Jack Roper, it was like, he wasn't, but it was like, that was the character he portrayed. Right.
And as a joke.
Yeah, as a joke. And I remember watching that going, well, I think he's funny. I love that show. But is that what it means for me to feel the way I'm feeling, that I got to be this joke? Is that what it is? You know, and obviously I hit it, you know, but I think anybody who grew up during that time frame, male or female, but I think especially for us gay men, it was like, you can't be that, because that's not what you're supposed to be. And if you did, then, you know, you were damned to hell and all these other things. And then I remember right after my ex-wife and I moved to Southern California, I was watching Making Love with Harry Hamlin and the other guy's name. And I'm like, oh, my God.
Michael Onkin.
Michael Onkin. Oof. I mean, both of them. At that stage, I'm like, oof, they were both just gorgeous men. and thinking, okay, well, actually, this is a reflection of who I am. And it was so ironic, honestly, Steve, that I was watching it with her, because that should have been like one of many signs to her that there was something, you know, amiss with who I was. But I can totally relate to what you're bringing up here. So as you started thinking about, you know, pulling all the different levers it takes to bring this book together, you said you were a writer, an English teacher. Were these like essays that you just like along the way of your life you'd been writing, or was it suddenly you sat down one day and said, damn it, I'm writing this book? How did that come together?
Well, I've always been funny. What actually happened to me, and I include this in the introduction to the book, but, you know, at 6 years old, like, you don't really know what it means to be gay, but deep down, right, you know that you're gay. But so I had that going on. And then my dad accidentally, on purpose, hit me and didn't apologize. He was trying to knock me away. And we were playing this game. And I, you know, ran to my room crying, like, daddy doesn't love me, daddy doesn't love me. And my mom was like, oh, yes, he does, come out, watch TV. And so I finally, like, and there's an essay about this, but I finally came out and he never apologized. So from that point on, I thought, my dad doesn't love me. So, you know, kind of knowing that you're gay, thinking that my dad didn't love me. And then in the third grade, my dad got a promotion. He was a police LA County sheriff, and he became a Pomona policeman. And so we moved the last month of third grade. And I had been like, you know, popular and this and that, you know, in grade school. But then when we moved to the new school, in my 8-year-old mind, I didn't know anybody. I thought, oh my God, I've got to be popular. What am I going to do? And so I thought, well, it's not going to be academics. It's not going to be sports, clearly. I go, or I can be funny. And my dad was funny. He was my original role model. So I started doing a character voice and making the kids laugh. And then I was off to the races. So being funny, it's like you either have it or you don't. And you can't learn how to be funny. But if you are funny, then you can develop it. And so, you know, that's what I did. But that's the reason I literally chose at 8 years old to be funny, to be well-liked, to be popular. And so that was like the transition to do that. But back then, it was sort of like someone who's overweight, they'll make you laugh so that the person doesn't call them fat. And for me, it's like, I don't want to be called sissy, so I'll make you laugh. So that's part of the equation as well. But something that you said earlier, it was so taboo to be gay that I was one of the last ages that would have been drafted for the Vietnam War. I would have gone to Vietnam before I would have admitted I was gay.
Oh, I'm sure.
Like, that's how bad.
I remember quaking in my boots all through high school. Like, am I going to get drafted? Am I going to get drafted? And that was beyond the Vietnam War. But I was just like, that was still, you know, selective service was still an active thing. And I'm like, I just now, maybe it was my Seventh-day Adventist upbringing, which was a whole nother thing that screwed me up majorly. Because they were like completely opposed, like, no, you can't fight in war. You can't do this. You can't do that. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, and you know, all I ever heard my grandmother say is, you know, we pray every day that our boys won't get drafted. Well, then none of them did. But then I had uncles and stuff that did. And it was just such an interesting thing. But I agreed fully. I'm like, I would never admit that I was gay. I just, even though I had a gay uncle who was very well known in the gay San Francisco circles. He was very well known back in the 60s and 70s. I mean, I've heard he was friends with Harvey Milk. I have never been able to confirm that, but he was well known. I mean, he and his partner had two very, very exclusive restaurants in the San Francisco Bay Area, and it attracted the creme de la creme of everybody. But I never admitted to him I was gay, but I know he knew it. I know he knew it because on his deathbed, when I saw him right before he passed away from AIDS, there was a conversation he and I had around this. And it's interesting that you and I have a very similar space, because I hadn't really thought about it until you brought up the whole humor thing. Cause I'm pretty funny. People say, oh my gosh, you're really funny. You know, you've got this quick wit. You can pick up on something, you can make it. But until you said that, I didn't realize, yeah, that was me in high school. I was like, keep them laughing. Just keep them laughing, exactly. Make them laugh.
Right.
Because if I can make that, and I know, I mean, now I have friends that knew me in high school were like, We all kind of knew you were gay, but we were just waiting for you to admit to it, right? Then there were others of them that were like, we knew you were gay, but man, if you laid a finger on me, you were going to get punched. I'm like, that was never going to happen because I was too busy trying to hide it all. But
and sometimes people think that you're gay just by what you don't do.
Right.
I went to my 50-year reunion a couple of years ago, and this one girl who had a big crush on me in the eighth grade. And so she said, when did you know you were gay? And I was like, well, that's such a complicated.
Exactly.
Such a complicated response. And I said, but, you know, what did you think I was gay? Or she goes, well, you know, everybody wondered because, and this was in junior high. And she goes, because you were the cutest guy in the whole school and you never had a girlfriend. So it's like, because you're not dating women, people can assume that you're gay. And I mean,
yep.
But that was like my highlight of the whole reunion. Like, oh, I was the cutest guy in eighth grade. Okay, I'll take it. So, but yeah, there, you know, it's difficult as it is being gay. I went to, I was raised Catholic. And so I went to confession when I was 13. So right when puberty happened. So I was starting to have thoughts about boys, although I had no idea what to do with it. And so the priest said, you say your act of contrition or whatever it was.
Back right.
And I said, I'm having impure thoughts. So I was like sweating bullets that he was going to ask me like details, but he didn't. And he goes, well, how old are you? And I said, 13. And he goes, okay, well, that'll be 30 Hail Marys and 25 Our Fathers. I never do it again. So I never did. I hated going to confession. So I would never allow myself to think of boys. So yep. I could think of girls. That didn't turn me on. I couldn't think of boys. So consequently, I didn't learn how to masturbate until I was 24. So wow. That adds like a whole nother layer of,
it does. But that shows such a huge thing of what happens when these things are suppressed, which kind of leads us to the bridging the gap. It's like when you get to have these conversations with somebody of a millennial, a Gen Zer, I mean, even a Gen Xer to some degree. I mean, Gen Xers, I'm right on the cusp. I was like, I'm 1 year into the boomer, right? So many of my friends were Gen Xers, right? But it's always so interesting to have these conversations with the millennials and the Gen Zers. They're like, really? That can't be real. I'm like, well, neither could fascism and Nazis, but here we are, right? It's kind of like, it's just such an interesting space to see people not get it yet. I remember it was probably mid 2000, like right at the beginning of the 2000s. We lived in Southern California area. And we were part of a group. You talked about California Men's Gathering. We were part of a group called, it was either 100 or 1,000. I think it was 100 gay men. And it was a group in the WeHo, West Hollywood area, and that really focused on kind of trying community and being more like respectful of all the generations within a community. And the elders were like, they were sacred. I mean, when they got up to speak, you listened, right? And it wasn't like we had this tribe thing going on, but like, you know, there was the elders. I can't remember what the guys in my age range were considered, not really mature adults, but it's almost like you had the elders, the adults, and then, you know, whatever they call it, the younger generation. And their whole vibe was, let's have these conversations about what really happened so that the younger generation can really understand, like, here's what was really going on. This is the sort of stuff that happened, you know? So you're writing these essays, you're capturing your humor, you're doing all this sort of stuff. What was the compelling reason that's like, I think this needs to be something that helps bridge the gaps here? Or was that even intentional when you started?
No, that was not my intention. My intention always was to get laughs and be funny. And so the original emails, they were very, very funny, very, very esoteric. But then I started thinking of there's certain events that I'd been telling the story for like years. Like when I was a senior in high school, I was the movie critic for the high school newspaper, and the name of my column was Straight from Steve. And little did I know how ironic that would be. But my two best friends, they're very, very funny too. And when the teacher was out of the, for whatever reason, she was in the paste up room or she was distracted, but she always had like 9 vocabulary words, and we would add a 10th vocabulary word when she wasn't looking. So we started out writing stuff like, you know, vagina, penis, right, venereal, gonorrhea, right, stuff like that. So it was really funny. And I told that story for years. And so, and there were other stories about going on later, going on back-to-back dates, personal ad dates back in around 1990 when there was no internet, and then not meeting the person until you, you know, meet them for the first time in person. And those stories were so funny. So I just started putting the old stories into essay form. And yeah, the one with the back-to-back dates, which is in the book, they were so funny. And I thought, like, well, you know, maybe I should tell this story to my mom, because everybody else thinks it's so funny, whether they're gay or straight. And so telling her the story, she was always, you know, somewhat homophobic. And I would say stuff like, you know, she'd say, like, how's everything going? And if I said something like, oh, I started dating this guy, she'd go, okay, well, tell me about it. You know, and right, so when I told her that story, it was like a complete breakthrough. I mean, she was laughing so hard that it was like a breakthrough. And it's like, humor is like the medicine here, because she wasn't homophobic after that. So it was like a breakthrough telling her the story of these back-to-back dates. So I started putting those, there was, you know, there's several stories. So, but one of them in particular that was probably my most difficult essay to write was called My Rocky Horror Virginity Show. And it was about the time that I lost my virginity to a woman, like the one and only time. And when I wrote the story, I thought, you know what, in and of itself, it's really funny. And I told the story for many years, but it needed the backstory to have it really make sense. And so I had to go back. And that's when I wrote the thing about going to confession and then right, in college, having a breakthrough. You know, we read the Odyssey in one of my English classes, ancient medieval literature, and we had to read the Odyssey and the Aeneid. I'm going, oh, this is so lame. This is so stupid. I can't wait till we get to the Catholic one so that it's all going right, to make sense. And the Catholic one was equally ridiculous, the Song of Roland. So when I read that, I was going, all right, the hell with this. This is, I'm not going to be Catholic anymore. So that was a breakthrough, but I still had nobody to talk to, and I was so closeted. But in writing that essay, like the stuff I was doing, it's like, you are so obviously gay, but yet at the time I couldn't see it because the denial was so strong. So it was difficult right, to write what I'm thinking and what I'm doing at the time, even though it's so obviously gay, but I had to write it with the perspective like, oh, I'm not gay. I don't want to be gay. That's like the last thing I want to be. So that was actually the most difficult of all my essays to write, because I had to really go into like my backstory.
Right.
And, you know, it's actually, so initially it was, you know, all these funny stories. I used to do prank phone calls when I was 10 years old. And then I kept doing that up until like I was working in a department store, and I would get bored. And this was when I was like 17, 18. And I would call another sales clerk in a different department, and I would change my voice. And I would usually have a couple people as my audience. So those prank phone calls were stuff that I had told that for many, many years. And then when I first moved into my apartment in the mid 70s, we almost had the same phone number as the Department of Motor Vehicles. So we got DMV calls like all the time. And so when my roommates would answer the phone, they'd go, hello. And they'd say, is this the Department of Motor Vehicles? And they say, well, no, that here's the number. You got the wrong number. But when I would answer the phone, I'd answer it, hello. And they'd say, is this the Department of Motor Vehicles? And I go, well, yes, it is. And I want to thank you for calling. What can I do for you? And I would tell them the most ridiculous, stupid things. So that was like my entree into stand-up. I would start telling them my latest DMV call at a party, and I'd get this group of people around me. So I told those stories for like many, many years. And those are my initial essays. And then I had like five or six main stories, and then I ran out of stories to tell for essays. And so it wasn't until I became a teacher that I really became like a really good writer. And a lot of it was stuff that happened in the classroom. And people have no idea what goes on in the high school classroom these days. It's like crazy what teachers have to deal with and teach at the same time and deal with these
right.
students. So, but then I was so busy as a teacher that I only wrote like a couple essays a year, and I was a teacher for like 16 years. So it wasn't until I retired that I thought, well, now it's time to get it together. And so becoming a writer, it really didn't happen until the emails, like a little over 20 years ago with my high school friends, and then being told I write like David Sedaris and, you know, reading his books and, oh, I can do this. So, but then becoming a teacher. So yeah, it was much, much later in life. I was always funny, but I had never really put it into like essay form. It was more like a verbal, like telling stories. So yeah.
But I think sometimes these things happen. I mean, my book didn't come out till, I don't know, 2015. So 8 years ago. So I was 51, 52 when it came out. And I never even thought about writing a book. It wasn't even, I've always been a good writer. I will say that. I've always actually been a good speaker. So ironically, the things I've always been good at are now part of my quote DNA of my work. But podcasting definitely wasn't part of my, hey, let's go build podcasts. I mean, I didn't even want to be a radio DJ when I was growing up. You know, it's interesting, but these things rise up to meet us when they're meant to, and then they become a part of our world in a really beautiful way. And I feel like you telling the stories and sharing yourself and helping bridge this gap between the different gay generations. And even then, it doesn't even have to be just the gay generations, of like helping somebody see like, yeah, this is what it was like, you know, because I don't know that the stories, you know, I often think about, you know, the original, you know, indigenous tribes that lived here before, you know, the white folk came along, and how much of their stories. I remember when I was in, you know, grade school and high school, learning a lot about Indian civilization and culture here in the US. And I'm like talking to, you know, some younger kids today, and I'm like, is this being talked about much? Oh, we kind of touch on it, but no, I couldn't tell you much about any of that. Like Geronimo, you know, do you know who that is? I mean, there's just these like things that, it almost is like sad that generations beyond us aren't really learning these things that are so critical. I said to somebody the other day, like something about Harvey Milk, and this was a younger gay person. They're like, Harvey Milk? And I almost wanted to say, oh my God, that's like blasphemous, you know, but you have to put it in perspective of where they are in their world. You know, maybe that's not something that would show up in their world. So what do you really want the book to do for people that get to read it, besides give them some laughs and make them happy? What would like your intention behind the book?
Well, that was my primary intention, was to make people laugh, and people that read it tell me how funny it is and how much they enjoy it. But it wasn't until after publishing and like going to this gay networking event that I realized that there was a gay generation gap. I mean, I didn't even know that. So the first person was saying, you know, oh, you got to change that title. You can't have baby boomer in the title. Everyone's trying to cancel baby boomers. You used to say, don't cancel this boomer. And I'm like, what? And then the next guy I talked to, he was like in his late 30s, and he's going, well, who's your target audience? I go, well, probably gay men. He goes, well, yeah, but that's not specific enough. Gay men over 45. I was like, whoa. And then I talked to a guy in his 20s, and I go, is there a gay generation gap? And he goes, yeah, sorry to tell you, but there is. So that's when it got me to thinking that when people, one of the things I came up with is that assimilating the past can build community and facilitate the ever-evolving lifelong coming out process. The past allows us to learn without burden. It gives us strength and guides us. So I'm taking a more serious look at it. And another thing that I wrote, this was like for a press release about the gay generation gap. And I said, gay men are much stronger as a unified community that uplifts and supports each other. While the greatest generation is considered so remarkable because they grew up during the Great Depression and fought in World War II, perhaps the older gay community might be seen in a similar light as the greatest gay generation, because they lived during suffocating intolerance only to continue fighting the enemy of homophobia during the AIDS pandemic until finally generating an emergent gay acceptance and legal standing. So it wasn't until after the book was published and then starting to talk to people that it's not only just to make people laugh, but it's to build a connection between generations, which apparently there's like a huge generation gap. And I found I was at a book fair. That wasn't a book fair. It was the LA Pride Festival. And then when younger guys came up to me and I started telling them different parts of the book, they were completely clueless. They were like, oh, I had no idea. And so just sharing the past and my, and what a lot of gay men don't realize is that the coming out process never ends. So we continually chip away at it, but because it never ends, we always are in need of, like, you know, nurturing and acceptance and building our self-acceptance. And so that's become like a serious aspect of a funny book, is that bridging the gay generation gap, which I didn't know until months later.
Well, and I think it's such a beautiful thing. I mean, I see this all the time. You know, it's just prevalent. And then whether I'm talking to guys, you know, my age who are boomers, or I'm talking to, you know, Gen, you know, Xers, or, you know, as we go down, even I talk to my own children, they're like, yeah, the way gay kids see things these days is so different than the way you do. And they don't understand why there's such a, you know, difference and everything. I'm like, well, generation, we do see things differently. I mean, I see things way different than my parents do, right? But I think it's such a valuable thing. And I'm really hoping by, you know, being on here and introducing it to a whole new set of people and just really getting out there, because I think this is something, if we even just look at society right now, we are so divisive. And I see it starting to happen in our own community. You know, even in our own community, there's divisiveness towards transgenders. And I don't like that. I'm like, it's really sad. Like, we've all fought so fucking hard along the way. But yet, here's the thing. I don't know that the younger generation realize how fucking hard the fights have been to get it to where they can just, like, yeah, I woke up one morning, decided to get on Instagram and come out to everybody on the planet. If that had happened years ago, you would have been thrown in jail and
oh, yeah,
deemed crazy and all this sort of stuff. And this is why when you approached me about having this conversation, I was like, I'm in. We need to have this conversation. Because
a lot of the younger gay men, they don't realize that it was illegal to be gay up until like 1972, 73. You could be in a bar and get busted. It was even like if you wore a dress in public, like it was a criminal activity. So they didn't take the American Psychiatric Association.
Right.
They make it, it was considered a mental disease or a mental disorder. And they didn't take it off the books till 72 or 73. Like, it was considered a psychological disorder to be gay.
Yeah, so absolutely. And you tell a kid that today and they're like, seriously? I'm like, yes.
Yeah, they don't know that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So getting that perspective, I mean, the younger people, you know, we've come so far and we still need to go a lot further, but just having like a historical perspective on what it was like will make you appreciate your own current life even more.
Exactly. Well, Steve, I'm so glad you were willing and able to come on and talk about your book and share about your, you know, your journeys and everything. I've read a few of the chapters. I did get to it before the interview and I laughed. I laughed. But I also, not only did I laugh, I felt the beauty in the perspective. And okay, I'm a boomer too, so there's going to be some synergy. I'm going to get this, right? But I also have interviewed so many people from different generations. I'm like, this is a book that anybody who picks it up is going to learn. They're going to have some humor. They're going to have some fun, right? But there's some learnings in there. And I think that's the beauty of when we bring these kind of books into the world, that's where the beauty happens. So appreciate you, man. Really quickly before we wrap up, shout out your website. It is?
Latebloomerbabyboomer.org.
Awesome. Very good.
The technical website that has everything is Linktree, Steve Milliken. So that has the links to my social
everything
and the website.
Awesome. Well, very good, man. Well, again, thank you for putting it out there in the world. Thank you for sharing with my world here in the podcast world. And I appreciate you so much for giving me your time today. I appreciate
you. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
That's a wrap for 40 Plus. Gay men, gay talk, where size doesn't matter. We drop our bullshit, get over our screwed up fears, make bold moves, and live life without apologies. Don't forget to join us on Facebook at 40 Plus Gay Men, Gay Talk, where the conversations continue.